Welcome to Finding Your Identity, the podcast about helping you find your identity.
Welcome back to Finding Your Identity. This is episode 25, and I want to welcome you to this area of the interwebs that I'm coming to you from, where I'm sharing stuff, you know, like dropping some knowledge on you. And I wanted to actually try to cover a topic that might be kind of tricky to cover, but also might be interesting. And it's definitely up the alley of finding your identity. But I'm going to try to keep this one a little bit shorter because, you know, I happen to be talking to my stepmother, who, her name is Holly, who kind of suggested maybe trying a shorter episode just to see, you know, maybe I'd get a different set of listeners, or maybe the same set of listeners who are just happier because I'm not wasting all their time, because, you know, time is precious. Time is money. Everything is money or needs money. Anyways, see, this is why my episodes are an hour. Because I go on tangents and I get confused and lost. And then I'm like, where am I? How did I even get here? What is this? This isn't an ice cream cone. This is a microphone. Not that I'm going to lick the microphone, because then it would make the sound. See, okay. Let's reset. So I wanted to talk about martyrs. You know, this is tricky. And I only say this because, generally speaking, martyrs are deemed martyrs because of something usually tied to religion, you know, and it's kind of an unjust persecution of somebody. And it's usually the person's usually deemed it later on, you know. If you don't know what I'm talking about, they die first. They don't become a martyr before dying. So you kind of have to die in order to become a martyr. And sometimes it takes many, many years before they're declared martyrs. But I thought it'd be an interesting topic because, you know, it's on the path of you know, trying to find your identity in a sense. You know, I kind of like to think of it from that perspective. So that's what this episode is going to be about. And, you know, I hope you enjoy what I have to say. So hang tight. Okay, so what were you talking about? Ice cream cones? No. Ice cream phones? No. Micro cones? Well, I gave it a shot. I give up. Okay, just kidding. So, martyrs. And, you know, there are some, there's obviously plenty out there, but I don't want to cover all of them because I'm trying to make this a short episode. So, you know, I'm just going to say two names, Joan of Arc and Nathan Hale. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Finding Your Identity. Oh, no, I'm just kidding. I'm not going to make it that short. You know, I just said two names in there. You learned two people who were martyrs, mission successful, 3 minutes. Bam, we're done. No, but Joan of Arc, actually, before I get into that, I want to kind of get into the definition of a martyr, because to me, that's important. To you, it's important too. But, you know, what it's kind of defined as is someone who suffers persecution and death for advocating, renouncing, refusing to renounce, or refusing to advocate a religious belief or cause as demanded by an external party. And, you know, like I said, generally speaking, a lot of martyrs were deemed martyrs by the Catholic Church. And then I think most of those were then deemed saints, or many of them. But, you know, it used to be pretty closely tied to religion, but, you know, in recent years, it's kind of been spread out to kind of to cover people who died for a cause, like a political cause, you know. And so the two people I mentioned, Joan of Arc was religious causes, and Nathan Hale was political causes, or you know, I guess it was kind of a in a time of war. I'll get more into what I mean, but essentially it was political in a sense. You know, another example is like Martin Luther King, which is very politically tied as a to being a martyr. But what I find kind of interesting, kind of just to circle back a little bit, is, you know, it's often kind of thought of as, I guess you could say, like a good way to go, or some people feel that's how they're going to want to go. And I'm really speaking about terrorists, you know, like I think they make themselves martyrs because they think that they're going to, you know, gain, I guess, the respect in the eyes of their God or whatever, from their religious perspective. They're going to gain some kind of reward for giving their lives up, you know. And it's not just, you know, I say terrorists, but, you know, obviously that's kind of like Taliban and ISIS and you know, Al-Qaeda. Like, those are the ones in this day and age, you know. Obviously back to 2011, the terrorist attacks, they were considered martyrs, the ones who, you know, flew the planes and into the World Trade Center buildings, and, you know, they were martyring themselves for that cause, you know, the Osama bin Laden cause, the whatever the heck they call it, jihadism, I don't even know. But, you know, they had it in their heads that they were doing a good job, or, you know, doing something good, that they were doing a good job. They thought they were doing a good job, but little did they know they failed because they died. But I guess they were trying to die. I don't know. The whole thing is just kind of blows my mind, because you can't really, I mean, one of the key things that it, you know, it's kind of stated that the people who are living after the person has died will be the ones who determine if someone's a martyr. So that's like the whole kind of criteria behind it. And that is in an effort to not let the person who died control the conversation or control, you know, the results and whether they become a martyr or not. So, you know, it's essentially the people who are left, who are living, who are going to make a determination. And of course, you know, there's enough hatred from, if you're an American, there's enough hatred for the people who committed the horrible acts of 9/11 that there's no way I would ever look at them and think, oh yeah, they did such a great thing for that cause, or have any kind of sympathy for them. Like, oh, well, you just gotta, you know, you kind of gotta like look at it like they were really trying to do something they believed in, because that's BS. You know, they hurt and killed a lot of people and did, you know, massive destruction, and they're a bunch of knuckleheads for doing it. And I'm not gonna sit here and say otherwise. I know I just lost my ISIS audience, but whatever. I don't care. I didn't want you listening anyways, so move along. You know, don't think that you were going to get, you know, a guest spot on this podcast. So now you know. Don't apply. But it's just kind of, to me, it's kind of a silly idea, because for me, I'd like to think that whatever impact I'm going to make, I can see it through. You know, like, I like to think, I like football. I like to think a lot of the football players feel like they, you know, they want to try to get into the Hall of Fame, and they want to see the legacy that they made kind of evolve to the point where people recognize them as greats, you know. And it would be really sad if like a, you know, a Hall of Famer died before their time. I mean, of course they'd probably still be honored, but it would be sad to think that they never actually got to see themselves be honored. But there's obviously plenty of people out there who that's what happens, you know. It's unfortunate, but, you know, somebody does something really good and then they end up dying before they get to see what kind of good they did, you know. And, you know, whereas like others were kind of, you know, kind of thrust into it because they were told to do it, you know. So like the Japanese, the kamikazes, you know, were ordered, and basically they would have felt great shame if they didn't follow the orders and fly their planes into the boats in at Pearl Harbor, right? And so because of that, you know, that one's harder for me, because it's not even like they've really, I mean, they've kind of decided, okay, I'm comfortable with this, but they're just somebody else who's still alive after it is ordering them to go kill themselves. I mean, it's the same thing is true with, you know, the ISIS, Al-Qaeda, whatever, Taliban terrorists. But, you know, like that one is, I guess, kind of faith-based. And the other one is more, you know, from a military perspective, it feels like they've got great honor in dying for that cause. And so it's not necessarily a religious belief. I mean, I guess it has to stem from some kind of underlying religious belief. And a lot of times I have to believe that people are dying and feeling like they're serving whoever they thought they needed to serve in order for them to, you know, accomplish that. But it's what makes this kind of a tricky thing to talk about, just because it feels kind of like a sensitive area, and I don't want to offend people, but I'm also not going to defend people who are doing things, you know, for the wrong reasons. So after all that, I'm parched. No, I am parched, but I will hold it, you know, or I'll just wait, because I got to get through this, you know. There's a lot of stuff in this, a lot of stuff. I got to cram it in. It's going to like put it in my mental vise and just crank it and get that information down smaller. So let's jump into Joan of Arc. The quick story is that, you know, Joan of Arc, who is nicknamed the Maid of Orleans, she was born in 1412 in France, Domremy, Bar, France, something like that. Look it up. No, I'm just kidding. That's actually the place. So Domremy, Bar, France. She was considered a national heroine because she, how am I making on time? Oh, geez. Here we go. Anyways, at the age of 18, the delicate age of 18, although she probably wasn't that delicate because she was actually leading an army, a French army, to victory over the English at Orleans. And that is essentially what made her famous, you know. And then, you know, she kind of went on and grew in popularity and eventually was a target. And, you know, she became such a target that, you know, the English wanted her captured. And they ended up capturing her and trying her and basically, you know, finding some way to just say, oh, she's guilty. And then they sentenced her to death and they actually burned her at the stake, which is horrifying. Oh my gosh. Yes, that's just a horrifying thought. But, you know, that's kind of that's a summary of what happened. Now, what's interesting is she was a peasant and, you know, she kind of had, obviously she didn't come from any kind of nobility, and she had, you know, humble peasant parents, and it really was just kind of, I guess, her own will. I mean, remember, she was only 18 when she led the army. So leading up to that, she was like 12 or 13 or 14 when she kind of was, you know, trying to appeal to the king to try to, you know, because the English were so repressive, oppressive, stupid. Yeah, they, you know, the English, no offense to the current English, you know, but the old English were kind of jerks, you know. And being an American, I can kind of say, you know, we kind of had to do something to stop them from being such jerks, obviously. But that's a different story. So the thing that was interesting is that she just, you know, she actually was able to kind of speak up and speak loud enough and say, hey, listen, I can help save the French here. So why don't you give me a shot? And, you know, it's kind of amazing that the king at the time, King Charles, actually was King Charles the VI, what's that, six? No. Yeah, six. King Charles the VI. He actually kind of took her seriously and said, hey, let's vet her. Let's just see if anything's wrong. And, you know, she went through her words and, you know, some of her actions kind of proved herself and was actually able to, you know, get to a point where she was able to lead an army. So I'd say that's kind of impressive. Now, she kind of, you know, this was all 1400s, late 1400s, middle to late 1400s when she died. And that was kind of that. It was kind of put to bed as like she was bad. They called her a witch. They burned her at the stake. And it took 500 years for the Catholic Church and the Pope to recognize her as a martyr and to actually say they were wrong and basically, you know, throw out her ruling and say, no, that was wrong. And, you know, ultimately that was how she became a martyr and then, you know, later a saint. But, you know, it's obviously unfortunate and sad, you know, but she kind of did this big thing. And you have to imagine at the time that was just like amazing. And during a time when women, you know, struggled to kind of have any kind of voice, like it was kind of amazing for her to actually be able to stand up and be loud enough for people to listen to her and make an impact on the world, you know, or her, you know, I guess a small world at the time, but a big part of the world because she was obviously then well known around the world after this happened. So, you know, that's the first person I want to talk about. I'm going to move on to the next one. The next person that I mentioned earlier is Nathan Hale, and I kind of like this one. I mean, this one comes up if you search for martyrs, political martyrs, or, you know, people who died for some kind of cause. But I like Nathan Hale because he's from Connecticut. I'm from Connecticut. A lot of histories in Connecticut and also, you know, Massachusetts and just in New England in general, also in New York. But, you know, Nathan Hale is kind of revered in Connecticut. There's like a Nathan Hale Museum or something dedicated to Nathan Hale. A couple things probably. But don't know off the top of my head, but I know that he's definitely revered here. But he has a famous quote you might have heard of and a couple other ones that maybe you haven't. And he said, and this was essentially he said this before he died or was killed or executed, but I only regret that I have but one life to lose for my country, which is just a great line, you know. And from a military perspective, you know what I was talking about that before, you know, with the Japanese, you know, people of, you know, the military background or that served in the military, they take a lot of pride in being in the military, you know. And my stepbrother David, who's, you know, I said Holly was my stepmother who gave me the idea to give this short episode, her son and my stepbrother David is actually in the military. He's in the Navy. And, you know, there's a lot of like we're proud of him and there's a lot of pride behind it. And I think it kind of speaks to people's character. Like we have to always kind of thank our military, you know, I think specifically our American military, and we have to think of them and treat them with respect because they're going out there thinking, you know, I don't know what could happen, but it's worth it. And I'm willing to put my life on the line because I love this country so much and I love the people in it. And I want to help do what I can to help protect them and keep them safe. And I'm sure you get to do some pretty cool stuff too. I think he does some pretty cool things, you know, and gets to travel the world, which is awesome, you know, but it's also the sense of pride that you get behind it. Like, I've got an uncle who served in the military for many years. He was in Desert Storm and probably did secret missions and stuff in different places. Who knows? But, you know, it's cool to talk to him with what he can talk about. And, you know, he has a lot of pride for it too. And you know, I've got other family members who served in the military, and it's always, you know, a place of esteem, like in people's minds, that you kind of hold them in high esteem because they're doing something that's great for the country. And it's just something to be proud of, you know, be proud that there's people who actually care about this country so much that they're willing to go put their lives on the line to help protect it, you know. And some people, you know, maybe aren't necessarily in the military, like in combat necessarily. They may just be more, you know, I don't want to say behind a desk, but you know, I'm thinking of CIA operatives or you know, people who might just be just kind of stationed in one place, but they're trying to fight cyber warfare, you know, that we're constantly being attacked as a country from a cyber perspective, you know. So you give credit to everybody who's kind of doing their part to kind of help make the country better. So I think it's pretty cool, you know, to kind of look at it like that. So what goes on in the, you know, what Ethan Hale kind of goes on to say is, it is the duty of every good officer to obey any orders given him by his commander in chief. I wish to be useful, and every kind of service necessary to the public good becomes honorable by being necessary. And that kind of just speaks to what I was talking about before, and military people feeling that sense of doing what's good because it's necessary, you know, and you know, that quote kind of can stick with you if you look at it from that perspective. Now, Nathan Hale was actually a spy, and he got caught by the British, and he got killed because he was a spy, you know. But you know, it wasn't until he had actually done a lot of good, because you know, he was passing information that ended up being useful to the Americans that were, you know, colonial army, Continental Army. The Continental Army and George Washington and, you know, all the generals, that it was useful to them to know like where the British troops might be, because, you know, that gives you kind of a leg up, and everything you can do to try to win the war is kind of essential, you know. So that was kind of a key role that Nathan Hale plays, you know, because Nathan Hale since he had to kind of go behind enemy lines, and he had to kind of, because back then, I mean, if you try to go behind the enemy lines these days and your enemies are, you know, in Iraq or Iran or, you know, Afghanistan or you know, in these other countries, where if you're a white guy like me, it's going to be kind of tricky to blend in, like, is what I'm saying, you know. Although there are, unfortunately, some very confused American white males, or even females, I think I heard, that have gone to join ISIS, you know, and been accepted. You know, I'm sure they have to do some crazy things to kind of prove themselves, but you're not going to easily just go blend in and be like, hey, yeah, go ISIS, you know, but I'm really doing it just because I'm a spy and I want to try to help end ISIS. You know, people are going to look at you, and, you know, unless this is a Family Guy episode, then, you know, then you'd easily be Stewie who does it and passes, you know, whatever. Anyways, yes, this is the sidetracking problem I have. Okay. Focus. So, you know, he was a spy, you know, like, so, you know, he joined the Continental Army, and he kind of rose up the ranks, and then he actually joined the Knowlton Rangers. That's what it is. The Knowlton's Rangers, which was the first organized intelligence service that was organized by the United States, and it was led by Thomas Knowlton. And, you know, so he was a part of that and, you know, already kind of doing intelligence gathering as a spy. And it was, you know, George Washington who essentially was desperate to find out what was going on in New York, specifically in Lower Manhattan, because the British were going to seize it. And so that's when he said, is there someone willing to kind of go behind enemy lines to try to find out information about it? And he was the only one who volunteered. And so he went in there to spy, and he actually got in behind enemy lines, and then Manhattan fell to the British, and he was doing okay until he kind of got duped by a loyalist who is someone who was loyal to the British crown, and they essentially tricked him, and he confided in them and, you know, said that he was a spy, and then they ended up bringing him in basically, and he ended up kind of going behind in front of a judge, I guess, or whatever it was at the time. But he essentially was found guilty of treason, and he was considered a outside combatant and sentenced to hang. And that's what happened. He ended up he was hanged at this location that's actually in somewhere. Where was he hung? I'm just looking because, you know, the internet's got to be somewhere somewhat helpful to me. But it was in Manhattan, and it was actually at 66th Street and 3rd Avenue. And that's one place that they claim to be. I'm just going to say that's the one, but it was somewhere in Manhattan and most likely somewhere near there. But, you know, at the time, you have to imagine it wasn't the kind of city that you know it as today. But, you know, he was basically brought out and hung and, or hanged, not hung. He was brought out and hanged, and that was it, you know, and it basically was kind of, you know, not immediately looked at as him being a martyr. It wasn't until years later, but, you know, for all intents and purposes, he was kind of honored, and, you know, Washington honored him because it was a crucial point in the war. And, you know, I mentioned this in that episode that I did about unknown identities and spies, and how there was there's actually this show on AMC. It was called Spy. I think it was called Spy. And, you know, that was kind of a time, and New York was kind of a central point for the spy operations, because I think of part of it was its location. It was kind of an ideal location because of the water that was surrounding it. So the British could kind of control it a little bit better, you know, and it was kind of a central port and central point. So, you know, that made it an ideal location to kind of hang on to, and made it tricky. And so, you know, spies kind of had to sneak in there somehow and pretend to be loyalists and try to find information. And, you know, a lot of that happened in New York. So that's a quick and dirty story about Nathan Hale. And hopefully I didn't get all the facts wrong. I looked all this stuff up, you know, but it was more because I was talking about martyrs, and he kind of pops up as a famous martyr, and he's more of the political kind of martyr, you know, as opposed to Joan of Arc, which is the religious kind. So that's why I figured I'd bring him up. Now, a last thing to say about Nathan Hale, which I think is kind of interesting. You know, again, I said he was from Connecticut, but it's like, you know, Americans kind of jumped on the martyr bandwagon, was like, we've got a martyr. Let's name everything after him because that's amazing. We've got a martyr. We finally have a martyr. I don't know. Maybe that's what was going through people's heads, but he's got, you know, dormitories named after him. There's a famous Revolutionary War fort in New Haven, Connecticut, that's named after him, Fort Nathan Hale. There's a Nathan Hale Inn and Nathan Hale Dormitory at UConn in Connecticut that's in stores. There's also a dormitory in Andover, Massachusetts, that's at the Phillips Academy that's named after him. There's the Nathan Hale Center at Robert Morris University that's, you know, in Massachusetts, I think. Is that Massachusetts? Or, nope, sorry, Pennsylvania. But, you know, it's like crazy to think of the list of places that kind of pay tribute to him. You know, there's all these halls and academic buildings all over the place, you know, in New London, Connecticut, and East Haddam. And there's, let's see, there's at least three high schools that are Nathan Hale something schools. There's, it looks like there's about five or six middle schools. And, you know, from Cleveland to Nebraska to New Jersey to Illinois, then elementary school as well. There's a ton of Hale schools. There's, you know, in Boston and in Connecticut, probably six or, you know, maybe four or five in Connecticut. There's Indiana and Illinois and Arizona and Chicago and New Jersey. I mean, you know, there's the United States Navy submarine, USS Nathan Hale, you know. So this guy kind of went down in American history, and he got a lot of things named after him. And it kind of goes to show the kind of respect that's kind of, you know, that's been given to somebody who's kind of went out and I guess in a blaze of glory, in a sense, you know. I mean, I don't know if you'd call it that in these days. Like, I have to imagine, you know, like, what the heck was that movie with the two women who, I want to say Laverne and Shirley, but I know that's not right. It was Thelma and Louise. Remember when Laverne and Shirley drove a car off of a cliff? Oh my gosh. No. Thelma and Louise, when, you know, they went out in a blaze of glory, I guess you could say, when they were on the run and they had no choice and they just held hands and drove their convertible off the edge of a cliff with 50,000 police cars closing in on them, you know, and that's going out in a blaze of glory, you know. Going out in a hail of bullets, not so much. I think it's lame. That's just silly. So anyways, that's all I did. I did a short episode there. You know, we're at 30 minutes ish, you know, and I hope you enjoyed it. And I hope you can make it to the next episode. You know, I generally do them once a week. I might be able to do them definitely once a week instead of maybe once a week if I'm doing them shorter, because I could fit in more and fits more into my schedule. But yeah, and maybe the non-listeners would actually start converting into listeners, you know. Maybe they can do it for martyrdom. I don't know. Maybe I would. I mean, not to say that I'm going to have to kill anybody, but I'm just saying. Anyways, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Finding Your Identity. And until next time, I'm signing off. And have a good day. And that's it. Well, I suppose.